The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, America. We've got a good show for you today. Three big topics of discussion. We're going to talk about the Department of Labor's efforts in the mining industry and safety issues there with a leading mining safety attorney in just a moment. Later in the show, we've got someone coming on to talk about the Kerry Lieberman Climate and Energy Bill that's been introduced this week in the United States Senate. And then we've got the editor of Maine Justice coming in to talk about Attorney General Eric Holder and his efforts to enforce anti-bribery laws. We'll also be talking about with her about the crackdown on Wall Street, the hunt for Al-Qaeda, and the Supreme Court nomination of Elena Kagan. But our first guest today is Mark Savitt, a leading mining safety attorney. I can't say that correctly for some reason today, Mark, to talk about a recent battle he won with the Department of Labor in regards to mining industry. So, Mark, welcome to the show, and give us a little bit of background on your battle with the Department of Labor and what its implications are.
Morning, Kevin. Thanks for having me. This issue came up where the Mine Safety and Health Administration, which is the mining equivalent of OSHA, in other words, it's OSHA for mines, accused a client of ours of not reporting an accident within the required time. There's a rule at MSHA that says there are 8 or 9 categories of accidents that need to be reported within 15 minutes of their occurrence to MSHA, so that MSHA can respond properly. And one of those categories is accidents with a reasonable probability to cause death. MSHA has recently started to expand that definition to include all kinds of accidents. In our case, it involved an accident in which the victim had a broken femur, essentially a broken leg or the upper bone in his leg, and was life-flighted to the hospital. MSHA suggested that because he was life-flighted and because he needed surgery and because of the seriousness of the injury, there was a reasonable probability to cause death, and we contested it. And recently the judge issued a decision ruling that it was not part of that category, didn't have a reasonable probability of causing death. And that was a relatively significant decision for the judge.
Interesting. And tell me a little bit more about the Department of Labor's arguments, and maybe is this a consistent position they've had over the years on things like this, or has the change in administrations resulted in some change in policies?
Well, the fact that the change in administrations has really put MSHA and OSHA into the posture of expanding their definitions and being more aggressive about these kinds of problems. And that's why the decision is so significant, because both agencies have done a lot since their new assistant secretaries have been confirmed to try to expand all of this. On the OSHA side, just taking a minute, on the OSHA side, there's been a consistent drumbeat from OSHA saying that what is viewed as an improvement in accident injury rates is nothing more than underreporting by the companies, by regulated companies. And when you look at a decision like this, there's at least a fair chance at this point that what they consider to be underreporting really isn't underreporting. It's just not reporting under the expansive definition that they've come up with.
I see. Very interesting. And obviously, I know, Mark, you spend a lot of your time advising folks about the enforcement regime of the Department of Labor and mining safety in general. So tell me a little bit about the implications of this for future enforcement and how it changes some of the guidance you give to your clients.
Well, in the past, we've been telling clients, and we probably will tell them the same thing, is that if they don't follow these kinds of expansive reporting definitions, they're liable to get cited by either OSHA or MSHA, but that we now have a real palpable ray of hope in this decision, and we don't know how seriously MSHA will take it, whether it will be discussed at the level above the agency so that both OSHA and MSHA really see what has happened. But we still have to caution everyone to try and to take into consideration the fact that there is an expanded definition of what needs to be reported, and that if you don't report it, you still might be cited. However, at this point, we're now telling people the chances are much better that if you challenge the citation, it will be successful.
Gotcha. Obviously, a ton of news attention came up with the mining disaster recently in West Virginia. Does this decision from the Department of Labor, does any of it relate to that disaster?
It doesn't relate directly, but remember that the category of accidents they suggested this fell into was one where there was a, quote, reasonable probability to cause death. The phrase reasonable probability is used in a number of different MSHA standards and requirements, many of which have been expanded tremendously since the disaster in West Virginia. And the judge's view on what reasonable probability means is easily transferred from the reporting requirement to the other requirements, and that's where I think this decision will have a tremendous impact on the MSHA side.
Okay, very good. And obviously, mining is a very discreet and important industry here in the United States. But what do you see, Mark, about this decision that has broader implications for other industries that are regulated by the Department of Labor?
Well, everybody essentially, except for mining, is regulated by OSHA to one extent or another. And that phrase, reasonable probability, and these kinds of expansive definitions are spreading all over every industry. And I think this decision, even though it's an MSHA decision, would be very useful in the OSHA context as well to show that the expanded view that these agencies are taking, the more aggressive view, is really not correct, and it doesn't hew to the regulatory or statutory language that they are required to follow.
Let me go off track a little bit, Mark. Is it one of the things that fascinates me when all these problems come up is people talk about XYZ, the entity had 14 violations and whatnot. And it seems to me like if you have an aggressive enforcement regime from OSHA, that those violations are bound to sort of tick up. And that, and many times that's needed to help and fix problems. But can you talk a little bit about that? Is that the natural byproduct of having more aggressive enforcement? Is it you have more violations and maybe they're more ticky-tack things that need to get fixed?
Yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt, but that's exactly right. As they expand their enforcement, become more aggressive, they pick on less and less significant kinds of problems. They get more and more technical. Their definition of a violation becomes more and more broad and gets away from the standard. It goes to what they wish the standard would have said rather than what it really says. And when you have that, it certainly does tick up the number of – it doesn't tick it up. It kicks it up. It kicks up the number of citations. And it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. By being more aggressive, doing more inspections, issuing more paper, then they can point to that and say, see, everybody's really unsafe. But the issue of compliance and safety are really two separate things, and we need to start looking at them that way because that's the way the agencies are really going.
Yeah, it seems to me to be the regulatory equivalent of having a lot of traffic cops writing speeding tickets instead of catching bank robbers and people that are muggers and whatnot. We need to focus on the big problem and not on the ticky-tack stuff. So go ahead, Mark. I'm sorry.
No, all I was going to say was the analogy on the MSHA side is imagine if, and this is, happens a lot, that they're people have large numbers of inspections, but they have more inspector days than they have inspections. So just imagine every time you leave anywhere in your car, one or more undercover unmarked police cars will follow you. And if for any reason you ever violate anything, in other words, go 1 mile above the speed limit, stop an inch over the stop line, you get a ticket for that.
And I've seen a lot of trouble just based on this morning's drive to work.
Less than one per day.
I'm not sure I'd ever get to work without those guys pulling me over then. Well, let me ask you, does any of this have I know that there was a lot of legislative activity in the wake of that mine disaster in West Virginia, as there typically is in Washington. So does something like the decision that you've been talking about here today at Labor have any impact on that legislation?
I hope it will, but I don't think it will. The only legislation it's actually introduced would require greater SEC reporting for MSHA-regulated companies. And what essentially the bills are requiring is that a bunch of data that is all public, it's all available on the MSHA website and it's all easy to find, be loaded into a bunch of SEC reports, which I don't see doing anything but just confusing people, creating a lot of issues that don't really exist, but also just duplicating reporting. The data is all public anyway.
So you don't see a whole lot of benefit coming out of that, the legislation?
No, I don't. I don't really see it.
And what do you sort of assess as its prospects for passage?
It's just introduced, and I've been so tied up chasing violations and citations, I haven't followed it in the last week or so, but it's just introduced in the last week, so it's a little bit tough to figure out.
So, Mark, I got about 90 seconds left, so maybe a couple of last pieces of sage advice for people in this industry on what they need to do to make sure they're doing their best to comply with this new regulatory regime.
Well, I think the paradigm has changed. The folks that run the agencies are taking a completely different approach. You need to consider compliance as a separate issue from safety because they are becoming less and less related based on the aggressive nature of the agencies and the expanded definitions they're using, and understand that you need you may need to prepare for things that you hadn't prepared for before, but that based on this decision, there's at least a ray of hope that the judges will start to dial it back to where it's, again, reasonable.
Excellent. Well, we've been joined by mining safety attorney Mark Savitt, and we'll be back in just a minute to talk. We're going to transition from mining safety to the big energy bill, the Carrie Lieberman bill that's just been introduced in the Senate this week. We'll be back in just a moment with more Capital Thinking.
Thank you, Kevin.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle. Whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on. Boom.
Golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, a busy week in the United States Senate where they are continuing to debate financial reform. And now they're looking at addressing another major issue this summer with the introduction this week of long-awaited energy legislation from the team of John Kerry of Massachusetts and Joe Lieberman of Connecticut. Joining us to talk about the fate of that legislation is our resident energy guru, that's Josh Green. Josh, welcome back. How are you today?
I'm good, Kevin. Glad to be back.
Well, give us sort of the big picture perspective. I know the House passed a bill last year that was very controversial and difficult for them to get through, and it has taken months even for the Senate to get to this point of introducing their bill. So tell us a little bit about the goodies that are in Kerry Lieberman.
Sure. And you know, to give the listener some context, so as Kevin, as you alluded to, the House did pass their version of a climate bill, climate-slash-energy bill, otherwise known as Waxman-Markey, last June. And as you said, it's taken the Senate a while to get to this point. And part of the reason was that many in the Senate, for both political and substantive reasons, thought that the Waxman-Markey bill, as drafted and passed out of the House, was pretty much dead on arrival in the Senate, and that there would need to be some changes to it, both obviously substantially and structurally, to get the requisite votes. Well, it's taken months upon months upon months of negotiation, and here we are with a product that, for all intents and purposes, still establishes a cap-and-trade regime and a carbon regulatory regime for the country, but does so in a slightly different manner. And the key difference really is, while the Waxman-Markey bill took an economy-wide approach in terms of this cap-and-trade program and a host of regulated industries would fall under it and would have to fall in lockstep with the carbon reduction strategies therein, the Kerry Lieberman product does something similar. However, it does it by sector, and with first the power sector coming into compliance, then the industrial sector, so big manufacturers of cement, steel, things like that. And one of the other key differences is the way in which the transportation sector and emissions from automobiles, trucks, buses, et cetera, are dealt with. And this has been characterized in many circles as a potential deal or compromise with the oil and gas industry, principally the major oil companies and refiners, to get some additional political support on the Senate side. And instead of really going after all of both the process emissions, meaning the emissions of CO2 and other greenhouse gases that are involved in the extraction of oil and petroleum and the refining of it at the site, you would, like the Waxman-Markey bill, it would deal with that, but it would also deal with the emissions that come out of someone's tailpipe. Well, the Senate approach is leaving those tailpipe emission related to fuel economy rules, and rather just kind of dealing with the process emissions of the oil industry and doing it in such a way that, hey, three major oil companies are endorsing the bill, BP, Shell, and ConocoPhillips, and they're doing it in such a way that would help them better adjust to the carbon regulations. I know sometimes going into the weeds on this is difficult. But
yeah, let's talk about those three oil companies, because obviously this bill is being released at a time when we're still dealing with the Gulf oil spill out there that that on a rig that BP was ultimately involved with, and a lot of angst in the Senate from people in coastal states like a Bill Nelson of Florida, saying, I don't want any offshore drilling, and I definitely don't want a seat in this bill. So what's in the bill about offshore drilling? Because that seems to be part of any grand compromise that was envisioned for getting this to the finish line.
Indeed. It's a great question, Kevin. Included in Kerry Lieberman actually is an offshore, basically an oil and gas drilling title. And the way in which offshore drilling is dealt with in the bill is that there will be a 75-mile buffer zone around coastal states, and states would have the option of opting into drilling off their shores. And there's a process that's put in place in the bill by which adjacent states or states that feel as though some of their coastal lines and properties, beaches, et cetera, may be affected. Well, the Department of Interior is authorized to do a study of potential impacts to coastal areas if drilling were to occur, let's say, 100 miles or 80 miles off the coast of, I'm just picking a state here for the purposes of our conversation, South Carolina. What would potentially happen with a spill to North Carolina or Northern Florida or something like that? And only after that study would states be allowed or given the option to opt in. If they do opt in, and what the carrot here is, if you do opt in, then the bill allows for 37.5% of the royalties that would be taken from, obviously, the oil company that's doing the extraction. That would go to your state. The remaining would go to the federal government. That would be divided up into both a trust fund that would help for future potential spills, ironically enough, or land conservation and wetland preservation programs.
I've heard that provision described as essentially a veto power for the states, for South Carolina to say, no, we don't want North Carolina to drill off their shore because it could impact us. Is it a veto for the other states?
Essentially, yes, Kevin, but the caveat being that it has to be based off of what Department of Interior would come back and say is something that would be more likely to happen than not, what the impacts would be. Some of this language was, I don't want to be too crude to say cut and pasted, but was, let's say, extracted from a earlier proposal that was proffered by a bipartisan group of senators during the summer of 2008, when the big commodity run-up prices, if we all recall, before the market crash, where you first got this notion of opt-in, opt-out, and governors of the coastal states could opt in, but you'd have to get your legislature to pass. But they'd also have the ability to potentially, as you characterize, veto an adjacent state from doing it. So the added flavor from that earlier proposal of a couple of years ago is, A, the royalties, and B, well, the Department of Interior has to do this impact study first, and then from that you can start this opt-out process.
Now, I know, Josh, one of the big players in this was supposed to be Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. He was going to be the Republican who gave this a strong sense of bipartisanship. Tell me a little bit about why we don't see his name on this and whether or not Kerry and Lieberman can get him back on board.
Yeah, it's another great question, Kevin. Indeed, Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, was involved and kind of stepped into the arena, took a big step forward to work towards a comprehensive clean energy bill, if you will, with Senators Kerry and Lieberman, because he has been convinced over the last year, year and a half, that the nation needs to do something on its energy policy. And he was looking at it more so from an energy security, energy independence standpoint, and the notion that, hey, you know, having cleaner air and cleaner water just makes common sense. So for many months, he had engaged in negotiations with Senators Kerry and Lieberman in good faith. And then, ostensibly, he got somewhat unnerved by White House announcement as well as Senate announcements that the energy and climate bill that they had been diligently working on was going to be put on the back burner while the Senate would turn its attention to immigration reform, which, of course, is another issue that he had been working on and still is on a bipartisan basis with Senator Chuck Schumer, a Democrat of New York. He felt as though it was a somewhat of a political ploy, and I know this was reported widely. I just felt, just from talking to his staff and others that have been working with him, that he just felt a little insulted by that process, especially given all the work that he had put in, and decided to back away because he thought that some politics were overriding the decision to move forward on climate. So while he has disengaged currently, he still has an interest in moving forward on something, and if the requisite political support can be gleaned, he'll be there in the end.
Gotcha. Tell me a little bit, I got about 2 minutes left. Josh, tell me some of the big winners in the Senate bill that aren't winners in the House bill.
Straight away, the two biggest winners, I would say, are the nuclear power industry and the natural gas industry. The incentives that have been put in place, the additional incentives, I should say, that have been put in place in the Kerry-Lieberman bill for the expansion of nuclear power, really is diametrically opposite what was put in the Waxman-Markey bill. One of the big ticket items was increasing the Department of Energy's loan guarantee program to authorize an additional $54 billion worth of nuclear power plant loan guarantees. There are also a host of incentives in there to help the expediting of permitting and construction. And then for the natural gas industry, there are two things that were put into the Senate bill that were not in the House bill that will help them. One, additional incentives for utilities, especially coal-fired utilities, to what we call repower to natural gas, to lower their greenhouse gas emissions footprint, their carbon footprint. And the second thing is there is a new title for the further incentivization of natural gas vehicles, both passenger vehicles as well as fleet vehicles, heavy-duty trucks, buses, et cetera. That is something that's not in Waxman-Markey, that's in this bill. It's grafted off of some freestanding legislation that would help the natural gas industry. But those two industries, I would say, if I was looking at two in Kerry Lieberman, are the ones that really are big winners.
Well, Josh, we're going to have to stop there. We will certainly bring you back as circumstances warrant to talk about the development of the Kerry Lieberman energy bill in the Senate. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk with one of the leading writers at MaineJustice.com.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202. 457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Sports.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball,
off the glass,
football,
come on,
football, golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, we are touring the halls of power on this week's show. We talked a little bit about Department of Labor early on, and then we were talking energy, Department of Energy, and congressional legislation in the last segment. Now we're going to switch over to the halls of the Department of Justice, and joining us for this section is Mary Jacoby, the editor of Maine Justice. That's mainejustice.com, a great website. Mary, welcome to the show. I know this is your first time on. We really appreciate you having you. And to give folks a little background on you, you're somebody who's an award-winning reporter who worked at the Wall Street Journal, the Chicago Tribune, and the St. Petersburg Times. And then you've decided to leave mainstream journalism, as some like to call it, and head over to the web and create Maine Justice. So tell me a little bit about Maine Justice, its mission, and its mission.
Sure, Kevin. I think you may have read a little bit about some of the troubles that mainstream newspapers are having with their own business models. And I'm really going back to my roots. I started out as a Washington reporter about almost two decades ago now at Roll Call, covering insider news about Congress. And we can see how that space has really grown. There's now three newspapers, including Politico, all
trying to
cover that.
I can't keep up with all the daily subscriptions I have from The Hill.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's other agencies in the government. It's not just Congress, but the Department of Justice is a really obvious one that have a lot of influence, a lot going on, and are really, really important, but no one's actually looking at them. And taking a cue from what I learned in my roll call days, we started out with a site that focuses on insider news about the Department of Justice with the goal of getting the Department of Justice to read us, which we've been able to do just spectacularly well. We have everyone, I dare say, from the top on down, and all the U.S. attorney's offices were bookmarked throughout the department, and they read us religiously. And then there's another circle of Department of Justice alumni who are now in law firms and corporate counsel offices who read us as well to keep up with their friends and who they know. And we're on the verge of launching some new subscription sites that will be aimed at specific legal practice areas with a strong social media component to that.
Actually broken some decent-sized stories recently. Decent might be underestimating it. But I know you were involved with the U.S. attorney scandal. Tell me a little bit about that story and how you were able to break it.
Well, we followed the aftermath of that pretty closely. We follow U.S. attorneys really, really closely. And one story we broke that was pretty big was Senator Max Baucus had recommended his live-in girlfriend to be the U.S. attorney in Montana. And that was a really big story because at the time, this was in the middle of the health care negotiations, and there were already questions about Senator Baucus and some of his ethical issues. And so this was a huge story and one we broke simply because we have our ear close to the ground on U.S. attorneys. I think we're the only site, I know we're the only site that covers the U.S. attorney nominations closely, and we have a chart, in fact, where you can go and click on it and see the pace, which offices have been filled, where the nominations stand, and we've covered very closely as well some of the offices where the Obama administration has simply been unable to find a nominee. And more than a year into their administration, these offices are unfilled.
Yeah, I'm looking at the chart. That's a great chart, and I see we're going to come back to some of the other things that I see on the site because there's some fascinating stuff here. Now, you've got a great reputation out of the box for since your start for really being on top of the Department of Justice. And obviously, as you said a couple of minutes ago, you have some fantastic relationships with key players there. Compare and contrast for me the new team led by Attorney General Eric Holder, who is himself a former DOJ veteran, with someone like John Ashcroft and Alberto Gonzalez and Mike Mukasey, who held this position during the 8 years of the Bush administration.
Yeah, so those are really interesting. Those are all distinct characters. So I'm going to try to be succinct. One thing I'll say about Ashcroft and Holder, they both came in at times of pretty enormous law enforcement challenges. I mean, John Ashcroft came in and had 9/11 on its plate and was out there out front quite a bit doing a lot of public relations, a lot of press conferences and things. And that was, obviously a huge news story. Eric Holder came in, and it's not exactly a 9/11 situation, but they did have the financial industry meltdown, the recession, the mortgage crisis, and there's a lot of securities fraud that they're going after, healthcare fraud, all sorts of white-collar fraud. They've really, really ramped that up. One, contrast I'd say is that Eric Holder maybe hasn't quite been out front as a spokesperson for the Department of Justice for much of his first year, and that got him into perhaps a little bit of trouble PR-wise as some of the more controversial decisions he made, such as trying to hold a civilian trial for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other accused 9/11 plotters in New York City. That backfired, and it gave an opening to conservatives, including his predecessor, Mike Mukasey, to really hammer him on some national security decisions. Perhaps, I would say a bit unfairly, if you look at the substance of what the Obama DOJ has done. But politically, they, scored some points. So more recently, we've seen Eric Holder get out front and do more interviews and particularly the handling of the Times Square attempted car bombing.
Holder, compared to his predecessors, strikes me more as an institutionalist. He's a guy who was, the district attorney for the District of Columbia under President Clinton, and then came in, he was the deputy attorney general the number two or number three guy for a long time in the Clinton Justice Department. And so he seems much more inclined, maybe more comfortable might be the right word, with who he has to work with, knowing so many folks there in comparison to his predecessors. Is that fair?
That's a really good observation, and yes, it's accurate. John Ashcroft was a politician. He had been the attorney general, state attorney general in Missouri before he was a senator. And Alberto Gonzalez, of course, we don't need to go over that history. We know he was a loyalist to George Bush and, of course, had to resign over the aftermath of the U.S. attorney firing scandal. And then Mike Mukasey came in to set the DOJ back straight and Mukasey had a long history. He was a federal judge. He'd been a prosecutor in the Southern District of New York. But I would say much more kind of openly, combatively partisan than Holder. Holder is an institutionalist. He has surrounded himself with people who are steeped in the law and the institution of the Department of Justice. That has helped him with legal issues. I think it may have been something of a liability for him on the political and PR side, as they apparently didn't see around the corner on some of these controversial national security issues where they came under some strong criticism.
Let's talk about that. Justice has played a key role in what's going on in Times Square bombing investigation. They seem to reverse course there from a solo guy to somebody involved with Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. So talk us through a little bit about some of the challenges DOJ is dealing with in these terrorism instances.
Sure. And I will say right here that I think that the criticism of them has been unfair, but this is politics, and maybe if you look at the substance of their handling of these terrorism cases, you know, the DOJ finally fought back after a long period of silence, which was quite damaging to them, I think, and put out statistics saying the Bush administration processed several hundred terrorism-related cases through the civilian courts. This is the way it's handled, and in fact, I've covered terrorism many years myself, and these trials do yield a lot of important information, and before 9/11 and after 9/11, good details are coming out. I'm not sure that it's a, if you look at the face of the argument, that it endangers our security by taking terrorism suspects and processing them in the courts. And I agree with Holder, it hasn't really borne out. But as a political issue, it's easy to understand, and it has been very fabulous, and the conservatives, including Mike Mukasey and people like Giuliani, have gotten out there and made a lot of points. So I think that with the Times Square bombing, the Holder team has decided that they need to be more proactive. And Eric Holder held this really amazing 1:30 a.m. press conference to announce the arrest of the suspect, and that showed that they were really trying to get out in front of the story. And it worked. And Eric Holder has, for the first time after more than a year in office, gone on the Sunday shows this past week and was on Meet the Press and this week on ABC.
Yeah, and I think he's probably in a tough situation. People, he's darned if he does and damned if he doesn't, because he was attacked for sort of changing courses using the Sunday shows to say that there is a linkage there. And you're right, conservatives have gotten a great deal of play out of just the general approach of the Holder Justice Department to approach these things as a law enforcement matter, which is a significant change from the way the Bush administration approached terrorism investigations in the wake of 9/11, which, of course, was very controversial. And so we've seen the pendulum swing back, and I imagine it will continue to be a political football that both parties have a lot of fun with, which they can do because that bomb didn't explode. Of course, if it had exploded, we would have a different problem altogether.
Absolutely.
Mary, let me ask you this. We're about to hit the break. Can we get you to stay with us through the break, and we can talk a little bit about Wall Street and the Supreme Court and a few other things?
Sure, no problem.
Terrific. Well, we are talking with Mary Jacoby, the editor of Maine Justice. You can find out more about Maine Justice at mainejustice.com. We're going to be back in just a moment to talk with her about Wall Street reform and other issues at the Department of Justice after this commercial break.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs
Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, we are talking with Mary Jacoby, editor of Maine Justice, a great website you can find at mainejustice.com. And Mary, let's pick up our discussion by talking about some of the challenges the Department of Justice is seeing in regards to investigating Wall Street. They're spending a lot of their time sort of cleaning up the financial mess there. You've got something on the website talking a little bit about how the financial reform bill usurps some of the Justice Department's authority. Tell us a little bit about that and what you think it means.
Well, we're talking about this antitrust regulation, I think, there's just so much going on. I don't even know where to start. The security, obviously, the financial industry meltdown has been a major impetus for a crackdown on white collar fraud and securities fraud. And we see that a lot of this is really being driven out of the Southern District of New York. In fact, they're using new tactics, things like wiretaps, things that they used to go after the mafia, they're now using to go after hedge fund managers on insider trading. I'm talking about the Galleon case and things like that. There is it is since 9/11, they have taken some resources a little bit off of terrorism and moved them over to white collar, and they've also gotten a lot of new appropriations from Congress to hire more investigators for white collar crimes. And the obvious reason for this is that the financial meltdown, the financial crisis, exposed a lot of fraud, and this is something that has become a very high priority, and they're putting a lot of resources after it.
Interesting. Yeah, that Southern District of New York is one of the best jobs you can have in terms of politics. It launched Rudy Giuliani's career, and many others I know have attempted to use it as a springboard. Let's shift for a moment. Obviously, big story in Washington this week is the appointment, the nomination Monday morning of Elena Kagan to be the next Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And she seems to have gotten off to fairly positive reviews here in her first week. You have on your website, I want to talk first about her replacement, because frankly, Solicitor General is one of the best legal jobs in the country. And so I imagine that there are lots of terrific names in the mix for that. Take us inside the process for Solicitor General and how people sort of try and get their name to the top of that list.
Sure. There have been a lot of names coming out. The obvious ones in the first days after this were Neil Katyal, the principal deputy solicitor general, so her principal deputy, who was a human rights lawyer and had done some groundbreaking work before he came into the government. He was also one of the ones targeted, I might add, by that Liz Cheney group, Keep America Safe. They called him the Al-Qaeda Five, I think, because he had been one of those in the private sector. I think he was one of the human rights groups that had filed on behalf of detainees. And so he's in the mix. We have Preeta Bansal, who is a general counsel to the Office of Management Budget, and Don Verrilli, who was a partner at Jenner & Block with the number three official in the Department of Justice, Tom Parilli, who's the Associate Attorney General. Verrilli was over there at the DOJ for a while, and then he moved to the White House Counsel's Office. He's considered very well respected. And in recent days, we've also had somebody from the political world mentioned, and that was Christine Gregoire, the Democratic governor of Washington State. And then finally, we've got a couple others.
She's term limited, right? I think she's that spot is up this year, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, anyway, well, actually, I'm not sure. She's in her second
term. For a landing spot.
So if she may be term limited. She's also a very well-respected. I mean, she's got a lot of allies, particularly Jenny Durkin, who's the U.S. attorney in Seattle, is one of her allies. And Jenny Durkin has a lot of pull within the Department of Justice, and Christine Gregoire is somebody that they'd like to reward. But they would like some diversity in there. More women and minorities are always helpful. Speaking of other women candidates, there's Beth Brinkman, who is right now an assistant to the Solicitor General, or she was an assistant to the Solicitor General in the Clinton administration, and rejoined the Justice Department last year from Morrison and Forster. And then finally, we have David Frederick, a partner at the Kellogg firm, and Patricia Millett of Akin Gump.
Wow, so some great folks. Well, let's shift back. Kagan is sort of doing her initial round of Senate visits to introduce herself again to the folks. She was just voted on as Solicitor General sometime 18 months ago, I believe. But what's your initial take of her nomination and how the process will play out?
I think that first of all, it's very hard to filibuster a Supreme Court nominee. And when she was approved, when she was confirmed as Solicitor General, she only had 7 Republicans voted for her. And at the time, some of them, like Senator John Kyle of Arizona, said, this vote is only for SG, for the Solicitor General. It does not mean that I'm automatically voting for her for Supreme
right.
Court nominee.
But I agree. They have no chance
to
filibuster.
But they're not going to filibuster. It's just not. It's going to be very difficult for them. They've miscalculated a bit on trying to stop this financial services reform bill. They know that. They pulled back. They're not going to give her a free ride. She's going to get, she has been getting a lot of gruff, and she still will get some grilling about the policy at Harvard when she was the dean of the Harvard Law School, barring the military recruiters about the don't ask, don't tell policy. And she'll be grilled. She'll be asked a lot of questions, but ultimately she'll get through.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. There's no chance they can filibuster her. We've got just a couple of minutes left. Tell me a couple of inside stories that we can only find out about on Maine Justice in terms of what's happening at DOJ and in the legal community in Washington.
Gosh, where do I start? I think one of the things that's sort of flown under the radar a bit is that there's a new Deputy Attorney General in the mix. Potentially, Jim Cole, who is a white-collar lawyer here in town in Bryan Cave, and he was best known when I was on Capitol Hill as a reporter, of course best known as the Newt Gingrich investigator, when Newt Gingrich was under investigation for potential misuse of his tax-exempt organizations for political purposes. And he's an aggressive litigator and a friend of Eric Holder's.
Well, that always helps. And mm-hmm. I'm looking at your website, and the train wreck that was the case against Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, that seems
yep.
to be your top story. Tell me what's going on there.
Well, and that's another thing that's flown under the radar, but you'll recall about a year ago, the Justice Department asked Judge Emmett Sullivan here in Washington Federal District Court to throw out this major public corruption case against the longest-serving Republican senator, Senator Ted Stevens, who since lost his reelection, and that was a huge embarrassment, and it was done because they believed that there had been some potentially exculpatory evidence withheld from the defense. And the aftermath of this is that the judge appointed a special prosecutor, a special counsel, to look at whether these prosecutors intentionally withheld information and thus could be held under criminal contempt. Court. And so we have a look at where this is going, and it looks like they're probably going to, the special counsel, Hank Schilke, is looking at these two assistant U.S. attorneys from Alaska who may have not appropriately summarize some FBI interviews. So we don't know. It's been very shrouded in secrecy. And you know, it's kind of interesting as well that you know they would focus on these two guys out in Alaska, and most of the Washington people seem to
walking away free.
Yeah, I mean,
I
don't know anything about it, but
having a friend in the boss's office down the hall. We will have to save that story though for another day. We've been joined by Mary Jacoby, the editor of Maine Justice, a terrific new website that is all things justice related. They are a great resource if you want to find out what's going on in the legal community, want to understand better the inner workings of the Department of Justice under Attorney General Eric Holder, and also what's going on with the Supreme Court nomination fight, anything legal related you can find at MaineJustice.com. We're going to be back next week with another terrific episode of Capital Thinking. You have a great weekend, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.